This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 10 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. In today's episode, we have Dr. Brad Segarin of Northern Illinois University. Here's our hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thank you, Max, and we're back for another one. How's it going tonight, Beast?
It's good, Woody. It's good, and the weather is warming up throughout the country, and I'm happy.
Spring is springing.
Yes, I can feel it in. Well, anyway, with us tonight, Woody, we have the lovely Gabrielle, and she's our correspondent on a piece that I find particularly fascinating. Hello, Gabrielle.
Hello, Beast. How are you?
I'm better by the moment.
Well, good. Tonight, we have Dr. Brad Segarin, who is a professor of social and evolutionary psychology at Northern Illinois University. He has done research on the psychological effects of BDSM and has been published in the journal Archives of Sexual Behavior in 2009. He's also been invited to lectures and non-academic organizations, including the Arizona Power Exchange, as well as the Cleveland Leather Annual Weekend and the Southwest Leather Conference. How are you today, Brad?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Good to be here.
Good. Well, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Wanted to start off, the LifeScience.com recently released an article, which was also printed in the Huffington Post, about sadomasochism leading to altered states of consciousness. The article references two studies, which I understand both are referred to as the science of SM.
Yeah, the work that we do is discussed, among other things, on a website that we maintain called scienceofbdsm.com. And the two studies that were written up in the Live Science and the Huffington Post, one of them was a study that we did where we were specifically looking at altered states of consciousness and kind of asking the question of whether people who do BDSM scenes in the top role and the bottom role, do they enter altered states of consciousness? And maybe it's these altered states of consciousness that's one of the motivations for people doing the scenes. The second study that we did, which is actually a kind of series of studies that we're doing, is really looking at the spiritual side of BDSM, where we've been looking at hook pulls that people do, where people get temporary piercings and then put ropes attached to those piercings, which they attach to either other people or static objects, and then pull against them to create pain, but then also which will lead to ecstatic states.
And I understand that these are referred to specifically at the Southwest Leather Conference as the Dance of Souls.
That's right. We collected data at the Dance of Souls at the Southwest Leather Conference in 2012 and 2014. We also collected data at a hook pull hosted at the 2013 Leather Levi Weekend in Northern California.
It's my understanding that you found similar results as far as hormonal levels and changes at the hook pull events as well as at the Apex Switch study. Is that correct?
We did. We've actually been seeing some real similarities across a number of different studies that we've been doing. And one of the, I think, really interesting findings that we've seen across a number of these different studies is that there is this disconnect that seems to be happening between what's happening to people physiologically and what's happening to people psychologically. One of the measures that we use is a hormonal measure of cortisol, which is a hormone associated with physiological stress. And what we've seen, particularly for people who are bottoming in scenes or for people who are pierced and doing the hook pulls, is that, not surprisingly, their cortisol levels tend to rise during the activities. And this you'd expect, given the physical pain that they're experiencing. At the same time, when we ask people to describe how they're feeling psychologically, they tend to describe their stress level as going down. And we suspect that this disconnect between the physiological stress that somebody's body is experiencing at the same time as the reduced psychological stress may be indicative of the kind of altered states of consciousness that BDSM scenes and hook pulls can put people in.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that when I was reading through your work that you tested not only the cortisol levels, but also testosterone levels. And I also noticed that the testosterone levels seemed to not have as much of an impact. There were some inconclusive readings.
That's right. We have been looking at both cortisol and testosterone, and it's exactly as you picked out. The cortisol responses seem to be pretty consistent from study to study. The testosterone results are much more inconsistent. And so while I think there may be some interesting things going on with testosterone, as a hormone associated with dominance and aggression, you would think that testosterone would show some interesting patterns with regard to BDSM behavior, but at least so far the results have been pretty inconsistent. We are going to keep looking at it, though, in future studies.
Now, I'm curious. I did not see any mention about endorphin levels, and that is something that is talked about within local BDSM communities. So I'm wondering, have you studied the endorphin levels, or do you have plans to do so?
I think that endorphins would be a really great thing to study. As you say, certainly the idea that endorphins are a critical component of the high that people get sometimes from doing BDSM activities is something that's talked about a lot within the BDSM and leather communities. At the same time, to my knowledge, there really hasn't been any direct research on endorphins. One of the reasons for this may be that it's actually a lot easier to look at certain other kinds of measures. Cortisol and testosterone can be measured using people's saliva. It's a lot more difficult to get good readings of endorphins, which require blood samples at minimum, as well as certain readings that if you want really accurate stuff, you need to get readings directly from the brain. And so there really hasn't so far been the ability to do the endorphin-type studies that I think would be informative in this regard. Having said that, I think it's pretty plausible that endorphins would be a piece of this puzzle, and I look forward to research that maybe in future years we'll be able to do or may come out of other labs that look at the question of endorphins.
I know I personally would be very interested in seeing some results of that, but I can understand with it being a little more invasive, it might be a little more difficult to find participants that would be willing to give blood samples.
Gabrielle, you underestimate the kinkiness of our community.
Oh, that's true.
I've seen many scenes where blood is abundant.
And I've got a play partner I'm headed for a meeting with that medical play is right up her alley. So
you may be right. It may be that, in fact, we could get a substantial number of people who would be willing to do blood draws throughout a scene they're doing. So far, what we've been asking people is just for their saliva.
Yeah, especially with some of the heavier bottoms out there who really enjoy needle play. I don't think there would be an issue there.
Brad, what I am hearing is that you are measuring what we have theorized and wrote about for literally centuries about these altered states that people achieve in these willing pain rituals, that these have been written about and theorized and discussed for literally thousands of years, and you're now quantifying those? Is that what this is basically about?
I think that's spot on. These altered states are things that, as you say, people have been writing about for years. And what we're trying to do is kind of bring in some scientific methods to get some objective evidence for whether or not these altered states exist and whether or not topping and bottoming causes people to enter these altered states. So, yeah, at some level, we're looking at really nothing new. I think the new thing here is to try to figure out evidence for whether or not people are entering these altered states and then trying to come up with some information about what the mechanism is, what's going on with the brain, what's going on with people's hormones that are helping them get into these altered states.
Now, I'm curious to know what actually prompted you to start these studies.
BDSM leather sadomasochism is a remarkably understudied area of human sexuality and human experience because, of course, BDSM and leather go well beyond just sexuality. And so one of the things that got me interested in it is simply that it's a pretty fascinating subject, and there's been surprisingly little research on it. So there's just a tremendous amount of questions out there that I think need to be answered. In addition, the research suggests that substantial minority of people out there fantasize about or participate in these behaviors. And so I think that the results of these studies really do apply to a substantial number of people.
I think that, and this is just my own personal opinion, that there are a lot more people interested in some of the milder aspects of BDSM, obviously less so than the more extreme. I do think that this would be something that would be very interesting for the general population to learn about as well.
And one of my hopes from this research is that as more factual information gets out there, that hopefully this will help to kind of counter some of the negative stereotypes that are out there about what people do when they're doing BDSM scenes, the positive relationship context in which these scenes take place and so on. I mean, for example, in the 2009 paper that we published in Archives of Sexual Behavior, one of the things we did was document aftercare. Mm-hmm. It's not like aftercare is going to be particularly surprising to anybody in the BDSM community. It's talked about in SM 101. It's, taught the first day anybody walks into a BDSM organization to learn about what they do. At the same time, this was news to the scientific community. Mm-hmm. And I think that just getting the information out there to, a psychological audience was very informative, because they discovered that, lo and behold, people who do BDSM scenes care about each other and care about each other's well-being and the positive experience that both of them are having. So I think that sometimes there's benefit of just getting what in some ways is fairly obvious information out there in a scientific context, and that can help to, bring about a more realistic picture of BDSM behaviors.
That's very, very interesting, going through the scientific to humanize this very personal activity that's often been demonized in the broader society.
Putting it out there that, this is not a psychological illness. This is not a mental illness. People who practice BDSM, which I know in the past it has been classified as that, you are bringing it to the forefront to say, hey, it's not a psychological illness.
Well, and certainly I think there's been a critical change in the academic perspective on BDSM. I mean, if you look not too many years ago when Freud was doing his thinking and other psychiatrists were doing their thinking, that there was a real effort to pathologize BDSM. And in fact, unfortunately, in a lot of ways, even in the latest version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, sexual sadism and sexual masochism still are in there, although the definitions, fortunately, now include a number of caveats that the simple behaviors, if they're not causing distress to the people who are doing it or impairing their life functions, are now not evidence of a disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's really helping that along is some research that's coming out that shows that BDSM practitioners are just as healthy, if not healthier, than comparable samples. There was a study that was published back in 2006 by Pamela Connolly that looked at 10 psychiatric disorders and found out that, in fact, in 7 of the 10 of them, her sample of BDSM practitioners showed lower levels of, for example, depression, anxiety, PTSD, borderline pathology, paranoia, and so on, than published norms for, kind of the general public. BDSM practitioners out of these 10 psychiatric disorders showed higher levels on only 2 of them, dissociation, which is associated with out-of-body experiences, things like missing your freeway exit because your mind is somewhere else, and narcissism. So really, on the whole, BDSM practitioners, the evidence would suggest, are a pretty psychologically healthy group.
Right. And that was one thing that I did find interesting when I was reading over your work. It's something that I've thought of in the past, is that BDSM practitioners do tend to be more mentally stable and suffer less depression, anxiety, and so on and so forth. And I was really thrilled to see that you had come to that conclusion in your studies. I wanted to move into something else interesting that I found. There was some data that you collected about some terms that are referred to as dom space and subspace. And would you mind telling us what you found regarding these?
Absolutely. The evidence that we got about Dom space, or what I sometimes refer to as top space and subspace, came out of the study that we did looking at switches. This was a study that was really looking primarily at altered states of consciousness. It was a research study, I should say, that was headed up by James Ambler, one of the graduate students on our BDSM research team. What we did for this study, since we wanted to find the causal effects of topping and bottoming, and as, you know, like everybody who took a research methods course in college knows, correlation does not imply causation. And so if you want to say something about cause, you need to have a randomized experiment. So what we did was we invited switches into the study. They signed up for the study in pairs and were willing to be randomly assigned to either top or bottom their scene based on a roll of a die. And I have to say, I am incredibly thankful for the generosity of our participants who were willing to come into a study and, you know, for science, were willing to find out by a roll of the die whether they were going to top or bottom in a scene.
Right.
So we brought them into the study. They did some measures when they first came in, including doing what is called a Stroop test, which is a cognitive test that's been used in psychological research for a number of years now, and basically is a test that examines the functioning of the executive function portion of the brain. Mm-hmm. And this is a part of the brain that we thought would be important in the altered states, particularly that bottoms might enter into. And so they did the Stroop test, which basically consists of, on an iPad, looking at a series of words that are printed in different colors of text. So, for instance, a participant would see the word red, but it's printed in green text. And their challenge is, as quickly as possible, to ignore what the word says and instead to press a button at the bottom of the screen corresponding to the color of text. When somebody faces a trial where there's a match between the color and the text, so for example, they're looking at the word red in red, those are pretty quick and easy to respond to. The ones where there's a mismatch, the word red and green, is a lot more difficult to respond to because our natural response is to read the word and respond with what the word says rather than the color of text. So we had everybody, both tops and bottoms, or people that were going to be topping and bottoming, do a Stroop test to get kind of a baseline measure. We then also got a saliva sample for them, had them fill out a survey, and then we rolled the dice to find out who was going to top and who was going to bottom. Mm-hmm. Participants then did their scenes, and there was an experimenter taking notes on the behaviors that they, the activities that they were doing. Right after the scene was over, we threw an iPad at them and had them do another Stroop test immediately. We also started taking some more saliva samples, and then once the scenes were completely over and aftercare was done, we had them do another survey to get their sense of how the scene went. And what we basically found was that bottoms showed a significant reduction in Stroop performance from before to after their scenes. Tops, on the other hand, basically their Stroop performance was just as good afterwards as it was before. And we interpret this as an indirect measure essentially of subspace, that the altered state of consciousness that bottoms get into as part of their scenes led to a reduction in Stroop performance, which is associated with a reduction in the functioning temporarily of this portion of the brain that keeps track of time, that keeps a sense of who the self is versus others, and so on, and that this then leads to that pleasurable altered state of consciousness, which is, you know, often called subspace.
I would assume that the reduction in the Stroop results after a scene had quite a bit to do with the increase in the cortisol levels that the bottoms experienced. Would that be correct?
Bottoms did also experience, yeah, an increase in cortisol levels, which may well come from either the pain for the scenes that involved, painful sensations, and then also for the scenes that involved bondage or other things like that, because the bottoms were also out of control, of course, of what was going on, putting aside, of course, that they, you know, had a safe word option, which kept some overall control over the scene. So certainly, I think what we saw in bottoms was both an increase in cortisol, a decrease in Stroop performance, and, you know, as well as, as we talked about a little bit earlier, a decrease in psychological stress. So people found it to be a relaxing activity, even though their body was finding it to be a stressful activity.
Well, I know just from personal experience, can be a little stressful going into, because you never know what you're getting into. But afterwards, you're very calm and collected, so to speak. I read through your blog that you had written, and Well, it's the first time you've had your research go viral. And that you felt like you kind of lost a little bit of control, and that, you know, some of the facts were lost in translation. And I wanted to know how this affected your team and how it affected you.
Well, you know, it was a pretty exciting experience to have the story go viral. Was also, you know, a bit disconcerting, particularly because I think that the first write-up that happened in Live Science and then was picked up by the Huffington Post, I thought that the reporter, Stephanie Pappas, did a fantastic job of taking a really complicated set of studies and just distilling them in very accurate form into, you know, a 900-word article. So I should say, I thought she did a great job of that. Where things started to kind of get less and less accurate was as the story got picked up by other sources. Then I think as the reporters did a little bit of a rewrite of the story, you know, for their own article, that's when, you know, some of these inaccuracies started to get entered. So at some point, for instance, the Stroop test, which is Stroop, became the Strook test with a K at the end. I don't know where that happened, and so on. And so, you know, I think as we saw the research go further and further afield, you know, I'd kind of cringe a little bit reading the articles. So, yeah, it was definitely a new experience for me, particularly given the fact that when you publish something in an academic journal, it typically involves, you know, years of doing the research and writing it up and sending it to the journals and revising the paper and so on. And so, boy, but the speed of things in the mainstream media is a whole lot quicker.
Right. I also noticed, because I was reading through, you know, the two together, and I noticed that there were some, seemed like a confusion in facts. I know that there were a couple of the hook pulls that were completely left out of the article, and that some of the results that were written into the article seemed to be confused. Some of the tests were left out, and I was curious to know your feelings on that in particular.
Sure. I think that when you take a pretty complicated set of studies and try to you know, write them in a summary form in a much tighter article, that inevitably some stuff is going to be left out. And so I think when I read the original write-up that was done on this, I thought that the author really got the essence of it correct. Having said that, you know, as you say, there were some things that didn't make it into the article, or that didn't into the article, but were a little bit, you know, mixed up. So, for example, you know, we collected data at the Dance of Souls at the Southwest Leather Conference in 2012, 2014, as well as the Leather Levi Weekend in 2013. And I think the article confused that a little bit, as well as where the results came from. You know, obviously, everything being 100% accurate would be preferable, but, you know, I thought that given that they really got the essence of the findings correct, you know, I feel like I could live with. And then in my blog, I tried to kind of correct, I think, some of the inaccuracies. And obviously, when we publish this in academic articles, then everything will be, you know, to the extent that we can make it 100% accurate. But it's you know, it's a very different kind of publishing there.
Right. An article tends to be dramatically shorter than a medical journal publishing.
That's right. Yeah.
How do you feel that your research is going to affect the BDSM or kink community? What effect do you think it'll have on it?
I hope that it will help, I mean, both in terms of getting more factual and accurate information out there about what happens in scenes, the effect of the activities on the participants, and so on. In addition, I do think that there are some findings that have the potential for affecting the way that you know, that people doing BDSM think about what they do. For example, one of the, I think, the really interesting findings that came out of the Switch study is that we asked people after their scenes how intense was the scene. And we ended up finding that tops rated their scenes as substantially more intense than the bottoms rated the scenes. And so even though, of course, the same activities were going on, but the activities were perceived as much more intense from the person topping than the person bottoming. And I think that's got some pretty interesting implications in terms of the way that people play and what, you know, I've certainly heard anecdotally, which is that scenes will, you know, often conclude with the bottom feeling like they could have had the scene been more intense, or, you know, they could have sort of taken more intense stimulation. And I think that, you know, we ended up seeing maybe one of the reasons why that happens that came out of our study, which is that perhaps bottoms and tops see the same activity as different in their intensity level.
Yeah, I found that particularly interesting as well, because I know for me, being a bottom, I tend to feel like it's quite a bit intense. And then when I speak with the top that I played with, it doesn't seem to feel the same way to him. So I found that particularly interesting for myself. Now, I noticed that you have some future studies coming up. In particular, you mentioned that you were going to focus on the caring behavior before, during, and after scenes. And you had previously mentioned aftercare. So I'm curious what other behaviors you were looking into in those.
So, well, one of the things that we're very interested in is the relationship context in which the scenes take place, and then the caring behaviors that I think in a lot of ways are representative of the positive relationships that exist between tops and bottoms. And I think these positive relationships exist both for tops and bottoms that are, for example, in long-term relationships, as well as tops and bottoms that may meet each other at a party and just decide to, you know, to do a scene. So I think that documenting what's going on, you know, the types and caring behavior that happens before a scene in terms of negotiation and so on, that happens during the scene as, you know, the tops and bottoms are examining what's going on with each other. I think often the top really kind of paying attention to what's going on with the bottom and adjusting the scene accordingly. And of course, with aftercare afterwards. And I think that these are going to be important things to document, both in terms of understanding that part of the dynamic of scenes, and as well as the fact that getting this information out there for people who are not BDSM practitioners to understand that these kinds of caring behaviors are a really foundational part of what happens during a scene, that it's not just somebody picking up a whip and hitting somebody else with it.
Right. Well, I know one particular quote-unquote ritual that is quite important within the community happens before a scene, and it's the negotiation process. I know that I personally see that as a caring behavior. Is that going to be something that you're planning on looking into?
It certainly, I think, is an important thing and part of what we do want to look into. We haven't looked into negotiation specifically, but one of the directions that we're hoping to look at are the nature and kind of dynamics in long-term relationships. For example, 24/7 master-slave relationships, I think, are you know, would be a very interesting relationship dynamic to examine. You know, what is it that the slave gets out of that type of relationship? What is it that the master gets out of that type of relationship, and so on. And I think because those types of relationships incorporate such a, you know, an intensive level of power exchange, I think there's a lot that we can learn out of the, you know, for those relationships in particular, as well as other types of BDSM and really mainstream relationships based on the type of negotiation and power exchange that goes on there.
Brad, do you feel a little bit like Dr. Kinsey?
Well, you know, fortunately, I guess, you know, we have the benefit of Dr. Kinsey and Masters and Johnson and so on, really blazing the trail. And so I feel like, you know, we get to have the benefit of all of their work, which frankly makes it a lot easier to do the work that we're doing now. I think that the types of studies that we're doing now would have been quite difficult to have done 50 years ago, both, you know, technologically as well as kind of in terms of their social acceptability. It does feel a little like that, except that, you know, there's just a lot of, you know, research that's come before that we're getting to use as a foundation, as well as the fact that, you know, society, while certainly there's a heavy stigma still associated with BDSM, but it's certainly gotten a lot more open-minded, and that's also made this research a lot easier to do.
Now, I know that James Ambler and Ellen Davis have both done prior presentations specifically at the Society of Janus in August of 2013. And I did notice that in your upcoming presentations that Sarah Hansen will be at Frolicon this year in April, which is a very popular event in this area with us being so close to Atlanta. But I also noticed that you are going to be in Washington, D.C. towards the end of the year, in the fall?
Yeah, James Ambler, Ellen Lee, and myself, as well as Bert Cutler, who's a member of the research team, we're going to be out at the Master-Slave Conference and are looking forward to presenting some workshops there. One of the workshops sharing kind of the studies that we've done so far, and then another, and as well as a overview of the academic perspective on BDSM activities. And then a second workshop where we really want to explore with, you know, with master-slave community what research, you know, they feel should be done on master-slave relationships. It's such a, you know, an understudied area. To my knowledge, there's one published paper out there on 24/7 master-slave relationships. And obviously there's just tons of work to be done. And we really would like to be guided by the experts in terms of what we should investigate and the type of research that they feel would be important.
Well, Brad, it's scary for us to open the community for this research, but also we know this research is very important for our community to be better understood by the broader world and for us to better understand ourselves. Do you see this research becoming a topic for more and more researchers?
I think it is. I think that as it's becoming more socially acceptable and less stigmatized, that helps, you know, for good or for bad. And I know there's been a lot of valid criticism of it. You know, the popularity of 50 Shades of Grey has certainly gotten a conversation going in the larger society about BDSM and power exchange. And I think that helps as well in terms of just, you know, making more people aware of this. So I do think that there are more people that are starting to do research in this area. And I have to say that I have been thrilled by the level of support that we have gotten from the BDSM and leather community in terms of the work that we're doing. Now, one of the things that our research team in particular tries to do is that in addition to, of course, going in and doing data collection when we can, we also try as much as possible to share the results of our studies by doing workshops. We have been going, for instance, to the Southwest Leather Conference now for 4 years. We have collected data in 2012 and 14, but we've presented workshops starting in the year 2011. And so we think that that's a way to, you know, give something back and also kind of show the community who we are, what our approach is, the fact that we are approaching this from, you know, a rigorous scientific perspective, but also with an open mind. And I think we found that, in fact, the community has been very receptive to supporting this research.
Now, I just have one more question for you. Is there anything that we haven't asked you tonight that you would like our listeners to know?
Let's see. Well, one of the other altered states that we've been looking at that I did want to mention, and we have started to get some evidence of this, is an altered state called flow. We talked a little bit earlier about the idea of dom space or top space, and we suspect that the state called flow, which is really a very enjoyable state of total immersion in an activity where, you know, time slows down or speeds up and, you know, the rest of the world kind of fades away. And we think that what's going on with tops who are topping in a really, like, good intensive way may be entering into this pleasurable state of flow. And this is similar to the state that musicians enter into when they're performing at really kind of peak performance, that athletes get into, that computer programmers get into, and so on. And so that, I think, is a state that we are gaining some evidence for, but that there's really, I think, a lot of other interesting work to get into to find out whether that's, you know, one of the things that may motivate tops, and that when tops are at their best, that they may be entering into this particular state of flow. So I guess that's one thing that I wanted to put out. And then I did also want to mention, you know, at least one other member of the team, Catherine Clement, who is lead author on our study on the Dance of Souls that we did at the 2012 Southwest Leather Conference. So we're revising a paper right now, and Catherine is a lead author on that. And so I did at least want to, you know, get credit where credit is due for the work that she's been doing.
Well, I definitely look forward to reading more on that. It has been a complete pleasure speaking with you today, and I think we and our listeners have a better grasp of your work. I would like to thank you for your time. You've provided us with some very invaluable information that I think is going to be great not only for the BDSM and kink communities, but also for the vanilla community as well. And we look forward to hearing much more about the Northern Illinois University BDSM team and what you guys discover in the future.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this, and I look forward to talking with you again.
I think it's great that you have a thing called the BDSM team.
Well, and if you want to see what we're doing, we're at scienceofbdsm.com. We're also on Twitter at scienceofbdsm. We've got a blog at Blogspot. So, come check us out.
That's great information. We'll also put that on our Hot Links page. So, Brad, thank you very much for the conversation tonight. We really do appreciate your time and all the great research.
Hey, Beast, it's mailbag time.
The bag's not quite so bulging, but I do see a sizable lump in it.
Well, the difference this week is we actually have the voice of the person who's making the call.
Oh, that's the reason for the lump.
Hello, Woody and the Beast. I have a question. I've moved to an area where they primarily, go with the younger folks. And it's hard for an older person who's looking for a play partner. How do you go about trying to find the older group when there's no munches around, only the ones for the younger people? If you can help, I appreciate it. Thank you very much, and keep up the good work, guys.
Well, caller, that is definitely a interesting problem and not an unheard of one. We are moving into a post 50 Shades of Grey world, and that book definitely sparks more with a younger group of people. There are older people still in the community, and I will make the suggestion that I'll make to many people that are having problems finding their own niche: become the lightning rod. Go on our favorite website, FET, and create a group for your interest. The group is often called TOG, the older generation.
There's chapters all over now for that.
Chapters forming everywhere, and you can go fishing, and you'll probably find one somewhere within a couple of hours' drive of you that can give you some feedback and maybe some connections on what way to go. But these groups usually are for 35 and up is their target audience. And these are people that have a little different outlook on life than the tweens and the seemingly tweens, these 18, 19, and 20-somethings that we are seeing, the millennials. And that may be the solution: is you become the lightning rod and other people will flock to you. It's always happened. Every time I've seen it tried, it's worked out well for the person being brave enough to put themselves out there.
What I've noticed is that the older folks are quieter in the social media, and the younger folks are more out there and commenting more. So you may have older people around you, they're just being very quiet. And so, as the Beast says, be the lightning rod and get people to come out and strike, because they're probably lonely too. It just takes somebody to stir the pot a little to make it happen.
Caller, good luck, and we'd like to hear back with your success story.
You have been listening to episode 10 of the Kinky Cast. Today we listened to Dr. Brad Segarin of Northern Illinois University. We want to hear from you with your comments or questions. We also want to hear your BDSM nightmares, so email us, questions@kinkycast.com, or call and leave a voicemail at 916-KINKY69. If you leave a contact number, we will try to reach you to join us on the show. Some listeners want to remain completely anonymous, so we have the Bashful tab on our webpage. Just type your message and hit send. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and Cassie, I'm Max. See you next week, when Raven Caldara and Joshua Tenpenny visit with us. Bye for now.